I call to order the City Council business meeting for January 13th, 2026. Clerk Clark, would you call the roll, please?
Yes, Mayor. Councilmember Arrear.
Here.
Councilmember Roop.
Here.
Councilmember Williams.
Here.
Councilmember Roche.
Here.
Councilmember Pinkerton.
Here.
Councilmember Tuso.
Here.
Mayor Shoemaker.
Here. Please rise as you are able and join in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have several presentations this evening, and we will begin with Rise Prevention, Inc. And Martine Helou Allen is the executive there. So if I'll give you the presenter.
Thanks so much. Come on. Yes, let's go. Okay, so I am so thankful to be here. I'm thankful to you, Mr. Roop, and also to Mr. Arrear for thinking that it was important for us to be here. So my name is Martine Helou Allen, and I'm also so excited because the room is full. And so I would love to tell you all what we do at Rise Prevention. Just curious, anybody heard of Rise Prevention besides those on the council? Okay, so we are a nonprofit, a public health nonprofit that is located right here in Simpsonville. You might have seen our sign off the road from three, and we're right there on the frontage road between West Georgia Road and Fairview Road. Our nonprofit is focused on inspiring and equipping youth to rise above the influence of substance use and addiction. I don't know how many of you here have kids that are in middle school, grandkids in middle school, or in high school, but we have a problem with substance use. There is a growing number of students, and the reason why I say that I can say that is because we see them. Growing number of teens who are using substances, whether that's vaping, THC, prescription medications as they're not prescribed to them, Galaxy Gas. There's a lot that is accessible to these kids in a lot of these vape shops that are around. Unfortunately, they can also get things that are over the counter that they can get at Walmart. So I would like to say this first. The approach to drug prevention that has been done in this country over the past 20 to 30 years has not worked. And so we've had to do something different if we want a different result. And that is what Rise Prevention is. We've been around since June of 2021 officially. But I started this program was when I was at the Greenville County Sheriff's Office. When I was there as the Community Relations Director, my main role was to look at the different issues that were facing Greenville County and to say, how can the law enforcement agency respond to this? From our position, using the platform of law enforcement to address these issues. And one of the seven programs that I made was called the Voice Program, which it was all about the opioid crisis. So when I looked at the issue and I was like, oh my gosh, how are we going to deal with this? What I asked myself was this: what are we doing to stop this from happening to more families and to more young people? I would venture to guess that maybe one person would raise their hands if I asked you, how many of you do not know someone with a substance use issue? How many of you have not been affected by substance use? Whether your friends, family, and your community, the recent break-ins that are happening, we're all affected by it. And so what I saw was there was not much being done, boots on the ground. Just Say No did not work. DARE hasn't worked. I'm hoping that it's going to. They're trying to implement it now newly in elementary schools. And so I went on a mission to do a lot of research on what it would take to make a great substance use prevention program and addiction in general. There's a lot of addictions that don't involve drugs that are just as debilitating for people. And so working with the FBI, the DEA, I was eventually able to take the program that I had made and all the research that I had done and go to the Executive Office of the White House, which is specifically the Office of National Drug Control Policy, in December of 2019. So I took this program with all of the data that I had, and I said, look at what I'm doing in South Carolina, little old Greenville, South Carolina. And they were blown away. And they said, you know what, this is what we need. We need a different approach. And that approach is rooted in relationship. Kids don't care what you tell them about the facts of drugs. They don't care because they believe themselves to be invincible. They also are looking for their autonomy. But when you get down to the root and what they're really looking for, they're looking for connection and relationship. That's why mentors are so powerful and parents are so powerful in children's lives. So I designed a program that is now, ironically, what is considered your evidence-based standard of prevention. And so I'm proud that we were just ahead of the curve in that. We did a lot of work, and now we stand as the largest boots-on-the-ground prevention program that is in schools and also works one-on-one with students in the state of South Carolina and in the region, in our Atlanta Carolinas region. So from that meeting in D.C., I was given technical assistance by the federal government to develop the program, which has now become our iRISE program that is operated through RISE Prevention. If you don't mind, I'd like to show you a quick video that we made. It will give you a great overview of what we do at RISE. Your average American teen. He loved soccer. Alex was your average American teen. He loved soccer, video games, music. He had a few close friends. But like too many others, Alex was carrying pain no one could see. His support system was collapsing. He didn't know where to turn. First, it was a drink, then marijuana, then harder drugs. Soon, Alex wasn't really there at school, at home, or at practice. His grades dropped. He lost his place on the team. His music, his spark. One in seven Americans over the age of 12 struggles with addiction, and 9 out of 10 began experimenting with drugs as a teen. Our country spends over $270 billion a year reacting to this crisis after it's too late. The world was reacting to Alex until one day, RISE Prevention showed up. At RISE Prevention, we show up to prevent the spiral. We mentor, we teach emotional resilience, we help students discover identity and purpose. I started RISE Prevention because I saw a need for something that could have saved me and many others that I know from years of destructive addictions. That something is effective prevention that addresses the root causes of addiction. That's why RISE Prevention proactively addresses this issue by reaching students starting in middle school, equipping them to rise above the influence of substance use and addiction, and inspiring them to believe in their worth and purpose. Alex was one of those students. He went from addiction to sobriety, from stealing to fund his self-medication to building his future. Every year, the number of schools we serve doubles. This year, we're bringing our iRISE program and support to almost 15,000 teens. We've got big dreams to go statewide, then nationwide.
There are many more Alexes out there. Our goal, stopping addiction before it starts.
Thank you so much. So you may have recognized that middle school. That's Hillcrest Middle School, right down the road. I am a proud graduate of Hillcrest Middle School and a proud graduate of Hillcrest High School. I'm just going to be candid with you now, okay? The reason why I do RISE Prevention is because of the wonderful people in my school who helped me when I was a student, whether they were counselors, teachers, mentors, who helped me to rise above disadvantages that I had. And to be back at Hillcrest, whether that's middle school or high school, to be serving those students is such a privilege for me, because it changed my life. And I saw firsthand, but I didn't know how God was orchestrating it all of my life, to go back and see those people that made a difference in my life and why they made a difference. As the video alluded to, I did have my own substance use and addiction issues. And that also played into understanding what it takes to actually get out of it and stop allowing the trauma that you've been through in your life to continue informing your choices. And also the way that you feel about yourself and your purpose in your life. So this is a very personal thing for me. You saw some of our team members. Man, do I have a great team. If y'all look on our website, they are phenomenal people who truly love the children that we serve. So the video that talks about the fact that we serve 15,000 students. We're in a school for 4 months at a time. This is not a one-and-done program. We don't just go in there and go, rah, 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 here's a speech about drug prevention, and I hope good luck. You know what I mean? We are all about mentoring. We stay with those that school for 4 months, and we also have groups that are in schools that are led by licensed counselors, so it doesn't put the burden on the schools. We also have one-on-one coaching that we do with students. Let me just tell y'all this. We are taking in doing 5 intakes a week of students who are either referred to us by schools or by their parents because they're struggling with drug addiction. We work with the alternative schools. We have a partnership with the Greenville County Youth Services, which is formerly DJJ, now managed by Greenville County Youth Services. We work with all kinds of at-risk and alternative schools. We know that mentorship and relationships make a difference. If any of you all are familiar with recovery, okay, and what it takes to get onto long-term recovery, then you will know that relationships are the key. And believing in your significance is the key to that. And also understanding how past trauma, adverse childhood experiences have shaped your choices. Because at the end of the day, it's not about drug use. It's not about addictions. It's about self-medication. It's about how are they medicating their inability to cope instead of learning those self-regulation skills. So what we have done at RISE Prevention, after all of the years of research, is we have termed what we do and our approach for the first time ever in the country, and it is now ours as far as owning the copyrights to this approach, is recovery-informed prevention. If we know what works in recovery, then why are we not doing it on the front side? Why are we not going ahead and meeting these kids where they're at, but also combating the societal norms that our children are being inundated with every single day, namely through social media? So we can do it. And there is hope. And RISE Prevention is proof of that, because we are getting excellent results with our students that we coach. Just want to say thank you to Hillcrest Middle School. They've been with us for years. Hillcrest High School, Bryson, Malden High School, Malden Middle. I know that's, but they're neighboring, right? So we just made a partnership as well with Malden City. So we're going to be helping them tremendously on different things that they're doing for the community outreach, and would love to do that as well with Simpsonville. We have a lot to offer to you all and a lot of resources. I will, with full disclosure, also tell everyone in this room, and of course you distinguished members of the council, that I am also a member of the South Carolina Opioid Recovery Fund Board. So I sit on that board as a voice for prevention, and we were proud recently at our most recent meeting to award you with for your plan that you set forth for addressing the opioid crisis here in Simpsonville. So that's just a little bit about us. I look forward to partnering with you all in any way that we can. For all of you in the audience, Rise Prevention is here for you and your families. If you ever need anything, we're right there off of Grandview Drive and would love to help you in any way that we can. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Director Hallou Allen. I appreciate that. If you would bring me the media connector back. Mr. Campbell, would you move the microphone on the dais to the lower riser for me, please? Give my council laptop here a second to reconnect. Yeah, this is the problem that I was afraid of. Here we go. We're back up and running. 4B, addressing the feral cat population, and I'll call on Aaron Bouchelon, who's department head with Northwest Health Sciences Department at the Greenville Technical College. Ms. Bouchelon.
Thank you. So I'm Aaron. I was asked to come in and speak about a growing problem with feral cats in Simpsonville. So hopefully, and you see that I'm Department Head for Health Sciences. I teach the Veterinary Assistant Program specifically, and I'm a licensed veterinary technician for the state of South Carolina. So what issues could arise with a growing population of feral cats are fairly significant. Not that any of these have occurred yet, but with a growing population, things could arise. So you have things and diseases like rabies. The rabies virus can spread very, very easily from one cat to the next cat. They can spread from animal to animal, and it really just is a mammal. That's all it needs. So that makes it a zoonotic disease, meaning it can transfer to humans as well. And so that is a threat. Another disease process that could happen are different parasites that can be spread to multiple animals, not only the feral cat population between them, but into pet population and human population as well. Different diseases that could also happen, not just rabies. You have a lot of different diseases that cats can get. They can spread it amongst themselves, and they can spread it to pet populations for the general public as well. Decreased food availability will be an issue. Right now, from what I've been told, a lot of people are coming around feeding the feral cats as they see them in parking lots and they see them around the city. They try to come out and they'll bring a can of food or they'll bring a bag of food and they try to feed them or french fries, whatever they've got. The cats gladly accept that. But eventually the population is going to outgrow that and they're not going to be able to sustain. So that's going to lead to problems with starvation, emaciation, and other poor nutritional facts that they're going to be able to have. They're going to be in search for food because of that. So their search for food means that they're going to hunt down sources that are probably coming from human businesses, human homes, getting into trash, making a mess out of that, breaking into things in storage. They can scratch through things, they can chew through things, and they can break in and cause a lot of damage to those things and try to do other kinds of damages to property. When they're looking for shelter, a lot of cats will go into engines and they will try to hide out in there, and that causes a lot of problems. Nobody knows they're in there once they start the engine up, and that can cause a lot of problems for the car and obviously the cat. Another potential threat would be the traffic accidents. As cats move around throughout a parking lot, throughout the road, people are going to try to avoid them, and so that means that they're going to be running around and potential of traffic accidents could occur. So there's things going on. The best solution that has been resolved was a process called trap, neuter, and return. So it's called TNR. And that is one of the research councils that does a lot of research based on cat feral colonies is the National Feline Research Council. They've done a lot of work to prove that TNR is the best resource to try and eliminate this as a problem. Right now, what's been going on is there have been community efforts, public effort to try to trap some of the feral cats, take them in for spay and neuter, but you're only looking at a few a month that can get done, and that does get costly. Cats have offspring all year long. They do have ebbs and flows. Mainly, they're going to have kittens between spring and fall. They kind of take a little break during the winter, but the population is still going to grow. The population outgrows the efforts per month significantly, and it creates a pyramid effect. So the cat can have litters. Typically, they'll have a litter between 4 and 6, but the highest litter on record that I'm aware of is 19. And so that's many more than what people can put in during the year to try and do a TNR effort. So TNR is a process that's going to allow the cats to be captured. They're taken to veterinarians. They're going to be altered. They are then health checked. They're going to be vaccinated, dewormed, make sure they're okay. And then they're going to be sent back out to a designated colony where someone's watching the colony. So they're being monitored. So their health status is being checked on. They're being fed. There's shelter established for them in an appropriate location. It's away from roads, away from businesses, somewhere that some people can come and monitor that. And those cats can then live out the rest of their lives in peace. But they're not reproducing. So that means that the population will eventually decrease. But it is a slow. It's going to take years for that decline to happen naturally, which is one of the major problems with TNR process. So it's a slow process. To make this cost effective from a city perspective, volunteers would be needed to do every stage of this, and that is capable of being done. Food, shelter costs are going to be ongoing until the population is in decline. And right now, though, mentioned how volunteers are needed, but the volunteers are going to be easier to find. Animals draw people. People love animals. And so trying to get people to come and help out and volunteer their services for these animals is going to be an easier process. There are a couple of ways that it could also be done. Approaching veterinary help in the city of Simpsonville is viable. Asking veterinarians to do a few different things, come up with options on their own, but one potential option is to come up with a donation of spay and neuter services, maybe one or two a month, or maybe they would be willing to donate a day, donate a Sunday a year where we could do a large spay and neuter event. We could do almost 100 cats in that event if we have enough people. So that's a lot of cats. That's a big dent. So you get a couple of veterinary hospitals that are willing to do that, then you've got two big events. That's 200 cats in a year, and that's huge. And that is an and/or. Maybe others want to do that monthly donation. So that's, again, hitting into that, and it's a big dent that we can put into that. So what's benefiting from this? Well, the first four are benefiting the veterinarians that are going to volunteer with us. So they want to be active members of the community. They want to promote their brand as being part of the community, being a service to the community. So this is a great way to do that. This is properly advertised. We have support in that. Their name is out there for that. They're going to bring in new clientele from this because they're servicing the community, and that really speaks well to new clients coming in. And with a growing population in Simpsonville, they're always looking for new veterinarians, and what wonderful way to find one, the one that's been in the news recently with helping the community. And the eventual major process, get the cat population in decline. That will happen with all of the support. One of the big factors is trying to help the public understand what's going on. One of the major things that needs to happen is people need to stop feeding the cats at those businesses where they are right now so that they are drawn to those colonies that we can create. So once those colonies are established, we have feeding, we have people monitoring those, and the people stop feeding them in parking lots. It draws them away from danger zones where they can get hit by a car. And we try to reinforce that people can be a help to those cats by letting them be with the monitors, be with those volunteers that are being fed, they're being cared for, veterinary care is available if needed. So there's a lot of things that can be presented, a lot of ways to present that to help stop that feeding process and promote that colony growth within the cat population. But kind of a short and sweet synopsis of TNR, but I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone may have.
Thank you, Ms. Bouchelon. Any questions from council? Councilmember Root.
Just a quick one. I appreciate you coming today. This has been a topic I think many city councils need to get a little bit more serious on this subject before it becomes an even bigger problem. Do you and other vets that are doing these, and maybe even other communities, is the Veterinary Association, I'm sure they're aware of feral cat issues. I find a problem, more or less, if I could be bold, they could fix a huge part of this. And I think by veterinarians petitioning for this could help a lot. And that's letting veterinarian technicians, certifying them to do, my daughter's a veterinary technician in town. She said she could do spay and neuters all day. She did it when she was in school, but they don't let her do it. And if they allowed another license for these vet techs to get to do those and take that burden off of the veterinarians, we would see this problem get much, much better. There's 10 vet techs to every vet. So I am not sure if you could speak to that, if that has been an issue that they are discussing. It's not a state issue. It would be their issue. I still think state dollars should be more dedicated to this. I do talk to our representative quite a bit about is there funds that they can give back to this problem. But just real quick, I don't mean to prolong the meeting, I am interested to see what the Veterinary Association says about that, and would there be potential for maybe down the road them changing that?
That has mixed emotions. Understandably so. But there is an option. There are a few states that have started to allow, it's kind of like a nurse practitioner level for veterinary technicians. It would assume a master's degree to be able to fall into that category, but those master's degrees already exist, and some states have already adopted that role. So that model has been created. South Carolina is not there yet as far as adopting that in the near future. I'm not saying that they won't, obviously, you know, with more states doing this and you start seeing the benefits. It's so new. There's not a lot of data out there as to how valid this is actually working out, but it's there. And so hopefully more data will come out to see how much use this can have, and more states will adopt it.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Council? Thank you, Ms. Bouchelon. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Item 4C, update on our downtown project by Jeff Hildebrand, President and CEO of Cotransco of South Carolina. Mr. Hildebrand.
Thank you. Thank you, members of the council and citizens of Simpsonville. Great news. Project is out to bid. Hallelujah. It's been a long, arduous process. Since we put it out to bid over the weekend, we've already had 9 different companies request packets. More people requesting packets is great for pricing. We've been seeing a trend now from about a year and a half ago to now that we're seeing prices come down, thank goodness, since the there was a big rush after COVID, a lot of things going on. So we're seeing numbers come down, so we're very encouraged what we're going to see. We've got a pre-bid conference coming up in 2 weeks. You're going to see orange vests and people all over the city measuring, taking pictures, and carrying their packets around, looking at what's going to be going on. Bids will be taken on March the 12th. I think I'm going to change that and have the bids opened here. I think this will be a great to do it right here in your chambers. Everyone is, of course, welcome. The public is welcome to come and watch the bid opening and see where it's progressing. We've been talking with T and some of the council members, the mayor, talking about getting a portal on your county's website or your city's website, where we can give updates weekly, biweekly, monthly, so everyone can see where we are. I'm planning on coming back as anytime you request to give you an update as well. So it's a monumental undertaking. It's a great project. We're excited that we're finally here. Just be patient with us over the next 24 months when you see dirt and cones. And you know, we're going to have, we'll post all the traffic patterning and detouring and all those things. And you know, we'll try extremely hard to not ever close anybody down and keep you from where you want to be. The downtown businesses, we've done this before. Fountain Inn and Greer, Traveler's Rest, Malden. So we're very, very attuned to the citizenry and the businesses and trying not to disrupt anyone during the process. And thank you so much for your patience, and you'll be seeing a lot of us. So.
Any questions for Mr. Hildebrand from Council? Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand.
Thank you very much.
Before we move on, I have some people standing over here to the right. You are welcome to come and sit in the open seats here in the middle or on this side. You won't hurt our feelings. You don't have to stand through the rest of this meeting. Each member of council has received a copy of the minutes from our December 9th, 2025 meeting. Are there any additions, corrections, or deletions to the minutes? Councilmember O'Rear.
I believe under business item 7A, I think Mr. Lentz's name is spelled with a Z. If we want to double check that to make sure, but I'm pretty sure it is.
So with the amendment of the spelling of that name, are there any other corrections, additions, deletions? Minutes for December 9th, 2025 will be approved as amended. Moving on to the next item, citizen comments. We will begin with Geneva Lawrence, who is here to speak about cats. If you would come to the podium and state your name and address, please.
Good evening, Mayor, Council members. I'm here because I have been involved with cats in the city of Simpsonville.
If you would, state your address, Ms. Lawrence.
Oh, I'm sorry. 207 Beatty Street, the Mill Village.
Thank you.
I've been involved with cats in the city of Simpsonville since 2000. I have crawled around down here in the park where they used to have the old picnic shelter, getting feral cats out of the attic, taking their kittens, paying out of my own pocket to get them vetted, finding them homes. Many Sundays I find myself at airports sending cats up north. I really don't believe anybody knows the extent of the dog and cat issues in this state. The amounts that we send them up north where there is, well, there just aren't as many up there. They have better laws, plus they have colder winters that kill them. I am still with the Barker Rescue Project. It's a 501c3. Two ladies came with me that are with 501c3s also, not the Barker. I have trapped in Village Park many, many cats over the years. We now, Edna Walsh just about has Village Park under control. She has a colony of vetted cats, what, three or four?
Four dead cats?
Yeah, three or four cats in your colony.
I have trapped, I have TNR'd 32 cats, paid out of my own pocket for them to be spayed, neutered, vaccinated, dual tested, and found homes for kittens. They're not even counted in that 32. And it's a crisis. It is a crisis. And that's one of many colonies that I have taken care of.
But then we have the tame cats. Many people dump their cats out into colonies. They think, oh, we'll throw it out here. It'll get a good home. That doesn't happen. A cat that you throw outside has no idea how to get food, how to do anything. One thing that not y'all personally, a former council has done to really tie our hands in the rescue is you've got an ordinance that says we can't have but four animals. I mean, why? I mean, I have two houses down on Beatty. I have eight cats. I'm entitled eight cats according to your ordinance because I have two houses. But you don't see them. They never, ever go outside. They are fully vetted. And if I have to take one in while it's on its way to transport, I'm breaking the law. Because now I've got eight personal cats, and now I've taken another one. And your ordinance says I can't have but four to a house.
If you would wrap up your comments, please.
Pardon?
Wrap up your comments, please.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I would like for you to look into that ordinance. That would make me very happy. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lawrence. Next is Jeff Rogers, who is here to speak about Hunter Street. And while Mr. Rogers makes his way to the podium, I do want to point out that I believe that he is here to talk about Hunter Street and not Hunter Road. There is a Hunter Road, so I just want to make sure we don't have any confusion what we're talking about. We're talking about Hunter Street. Yeah, right. All right. Thank you. If you would state your name and address, and we'll start the timer.
That's my wife's problem. I asked her to confirm.
Council, thank you for this opportunity. And before I start, I'd like to thank you all first for the outstanding job you did with this
state
building.
State your name and address, please.
Pardon?
Name and address,
oh,
please.
Jeff Rogers, 206 Chessington Lane.
Thank you.
For the outstanding job you did with this building, the grounds, the activities all around, it's just beautiful. It's worthy of Simpsonville. And I've lived here 30 years, and I'm very proud of it. So thank you very much. I think that deserves applause. What I'd like to talk about is in North Carolina through the legislature right now, there's H.R. 24 going through the legislature. And the legislation is Safe and Open Streets Act. And it's to make it blocking public roads a federal crime and to maintain open transportation routes. That's a federal crime. So what I'd like to ask the council to do is to get ahead of this legislation and review it, see how it might apply to us and how it might apply to Hunter Lane.
Street.
See how it applies to that. And going on with that, while you're doing that activity, I had the opportunity to go to Berlin when the wall was still up. And I'm reminded of that every day I drive by Hunter because it looks like a third world block. I've been to Europe and many places in Europe, and there are many, many ways to beautify a block off. I'd like you to review those and see if we can't get done with the ugly there on Hunter. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Mm-hmm. Sean Phillips.
Sean Phillips, owner at 302 Northeast Main Street. First, thank you for all that you do. It does not go unrecognized. We appreciate it. It is the hard work that nobody else wants to do. So thank you so much for everything that you guys do, truly. We're all cheering you on. There's a lot at stake. This is where we chose to make our home and our businesses, so thank you guys. But I wrote some more notes down. So, Mayor and Council members, I own three properties in League Estates, one residential and two commercial properties. One is my business at Weicker Realtors Sean and Sherry Group. I'm here because I did not receive the mayor's personal letter regarding Hunter Street recently. Despite owning multiple properties directly affected, I found out from an upset resident that wanted the street to be reopened. I also managed properties for owners in League Estates beyond my own to long-term tenants. These owners should have been notified and were not. Notices sent to current residents only exclude property owners and business owners like myself, and that is not transparency. This is history repeating itself, and why many of new council members are now sworn in today. Decisions about street closures and traffic patterns affect access, safety, and economical viability, and all stakeholders deserve notice. This leads to a broader concern about how traffic decisions are being handled downtown. Main Street was reduced to 4 lanes to 2, probably like a decade ago, with the intent of slowing traffic years ago. Instead, the current forced merge has traffic backed up for blocks in both directions with no clear benefit. What was meant to calm traffic is now creating congestion and frustration. Often I go to work or check on a property I manage and use the empty lane on Main Street. Many of those waiting for blocks in traffic try to cut me off as if I'm trying to avoid the merge and skip in line, not knowing I'm just trying to go turn left into League Estates. As a business owner, I hear this directly from the public. Customers openly say they avoid downtown businesses because of the traffic. I'm also in real estate, and they're telling me where they want to live and where they don't want to live, and I'm seeing a shift. The city's master plan to repave and redirect roads have taken many years, longer than expected, a lot beyond your control. And Main Street, however, is being neglected. That is in your control. Weeds along the roadway of Main Street, I've seen the whole entire last year. Christmas decorations on utility poles that are leaning over, heavily weighed down, and not one was the same height as the other. There's new banners also that were different sizes. It's not even fitting, not even a rhyme or reason. So there's also conversations of how downtown was so dim and dark during Christmas. Not the extra personalization of decorating trees and bushes along Ice Cream Station. I have offices in 3 downtowns. This is my home, and ours, unfortunately, is the worst downtown of all my 3 offices. And this is where I call home.
If you'd wrap up your comments, please.
So I've personally helped pick up debris and vehicle parts from accidents at my corner more times than I can count. I understand the medians are being removed to help those who need to turn. But why are we causing road rage, frustration, and danger for no good reason? It is dangerous to turn left on Main Street from League Estates. My recommendation is simple and actionable. Restore Main Street to 4 lanes as it once was years ago. Please address this openly, publicly, and with urgency. Safety, access, and our downtown economy depends on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Breanne Schaefer.
Hey, again, crazy cat lady. So my name is Breanne Schaefer. I'm at 113 Ashdown Drive. So I live here, and I also run a local nonprofit cat rescue, Fixing the Ferals. I am a 501c3. So as we all cat ladies were talking about today, right now the city ordinance limits us to 4 domestic animals. So this can include really anything. We birds, it can be your pet mouse, anything. So the issue is if a foster takes in 1 pregnant cat, they can become in violation literally overnight because, like she said, 4 to 6 is the typical amount in a litter. So we could be breaking the law very easily. At the same time, Simpsonville's zoning rules don't allow for most animal care activity to count as like a home occupation. You can't really run a business outside of, like, in your home that's public. It's kind of a weird gray area. So even licensed nonprofits and foster homes, they're really treated like we're running an illegal business. So I'm not asking for, like, unlimited and unregulated operations, but I think nonprofits and fosters should have a special exemption, or there should be, like, a permit category. I also want to point out that definitely TNR is needed. Simpsonville does not have anything right now. As I understand, I believe animal control, there's 1 officer, I think, and there's not space at the police department for cats. They only actually, like, take in the dogs. So we're also kind of relying like on rescues and everything. So in the long run, the city is paying for the same problem over and over again. So I know you pointed out about the whole vet tech and everything like that. I will say a huge problem with the spay and neuter is it's the cost of the medication to put the cat to sleep that is like a big hindrance, because I know there are vets that would be like, yeah, let's do all this spay and neuter, but that is a cost. Someone has to pay for it. So anyways, I just think the law basically is treating rescues the same as irresponsible pet owners, hoarders that have all these cats that aren't vaccinated, dogs that are running around, getting pregnant. I think it needs to be a little bit different there. Shouldn't really break a law just because you're rescuing cats. So I think really just a simple nonprofit and foster exemption, it would give the city oversight while allowing like rescue work to continue. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Thank you.
Thank you. Kim Johnston.
Hi, Kim Johnston, 232A Perry Avenue, and I live in League Estates as well, but the first thing I wanted to address is the cat population. I'm excited to meet.
She left.
Okay, so I need her contact information. A year ago, we had a small feral colony show up in the top of our neighborhood, and nobody knew what to do. And I'm like, well, if we do not do something, it will be tremendously worse. So our neighborhood rallied together and came up with the money, and I started figuring out how to trap. I was this close to quitting because I couldn't get any answers. The police officer that is also the animal control here, he does that on a part-time basis, and then he was traveling and had to go here and go there, and I couldn't get any answers as to what to do. Thankfully, just as I was over the edge, I reached somebody for Speak for Animals, and they talked me off the ledge and helped me learn what to do and how to do it. And so I go at 6 in the morning now to Greenville Animal Care with a voucher and get 2 cats at a time fixed. So that is a very small solution. We were able to get all of our cats in our neighborhood fixed, and we released them back into the neighborhood. And then they, you know, whatever happens after that. Now there's one in Redfern. There's another one starting there. And a lady put something on Simpsonville residents page and said, someone, please help me. I don't know what to do. I've asked. I don't know what to do. And so I'm the only one that responded to her. So we're working on that colony now, and I think we have probably 12 or so. We found two of them have found homes so far. So I think what I'm asking for is just some type of information. If someone says, please help me, point them in the direction of some resources, because we all need each other and we've got to figure out this problem. It's a huge problem. And one of the other things I wanted to add that she didn't mention as part of the problem is when they start inbreeding, when babies mate with their relatives and they start getting deformed and things like that, that gets really bad. And we had that several years ago. So that's really all about the cats. It is definitely a problem. And I'm very thankful for my neighborhood and the people in Redfern who are helping us take care of the ones that we have now. And then the last little thing is on Hunter. I personally did not like that it was closed in the beginning, but to see the traffic cut to nothing and that we can walk dogs and walk our kids in that neighborhood is tremendous. If it ends up being open, I just ask that you please try every other resource, timing the lights, removing those barriers, doing everything you can first to keep our community safe before you reopen Hunter. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Chelsea Vargas.
Good evening. My name is Chelsea Vargas. I live at 234 Perry Ave. We've lived in our home for 2 years, and so during that time, Hunter has always been closed as we've known it. We used to pass through on our way to church, and my kids would call it the street with no cars. It's quiet, it's residential, families walk with their children, their dogs, they ride their bikes. We have good friends on one of the Plinies, and we go back and forth to each other's homes with very little fear for our safety. I've emailed, and so I'll try not to rehash the things that I've said in my email. And I wanted to thank you, say thank you to the council members that did reply. Appreciate your input. And at its core, my issue is very simple. The safety of the residents and the children in our neighborhood. Whether the original closure was handled perfectly from a legal aspect, I can't evaluate. And whether other neighborhoods in the city have cut through traffic, that's not really our issue. The only argument that I've heard that has given me pause is concern about potential emergency vehicles being delayed. I don't have access to that data, so I can't speak to that, and I don't know if that's been documented for you all. But what I know is this. Reopening that street with our city growing as it is going to reintroduce traffic at a level that is just not appropriate for a residential neighborhood. That change is going to increase risk, particularly for our children. And that risk shouldn't be taken lightly, and I hope it is not taken lightly by any of you. Other options should be explored. I've heard some good options here tonight. I know you guys have a plan. All of that should be investigated before this is a consideration. If it does ultimately come to a vote, and that vote is that it does get reopened, and I personally vote that it does not, you need to try these traffic calming measures before you open that access to others, whether that's speed humps or maybe even considering a partial closure instead of a full closure, other proven methods with the goal to really reduce those speeds and discourage cut-through traffic. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vargas. Moving on to business. Item 7A, second reading of Ordinance O-2025-13, Trespass Enforcement Authorization Program. Mr. Coker, would you summarize, please?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So, of course, this is second reading, so it's come due twice. But basically what this ordinance does is it creates a program by which our police department may work together with private property owners to enforce trespassing laws on private property. And so as a program, it has to operate with the consent of both the property owner as well as the police department. And if this is something, if it's something that's acceptable to both parties, then the police would then be able to post signage and enforce those trespass laws that are already on the books. So that's a summary for you.
All right. Thank you. Motion is in order. Councilmember Pinkerton.
Yeah, Mayor and Council, I move to approve the second reading of Ordinance 02025-13, Trespass Enforcement Authorization Program.
Second.
Have a motion from Councilmember Pinkerton with a second from Councilmember Roche. Discussion? Councilmember O'Rear.
Well, I just want to thank Administrator Coker. He, I asked to have a little time with him to clarify a few questions I had, and I came in last week, and he made a lot of sense of it for me, and so I appreciate your time doing that for me.
Mm-hmm. Council? On the motion to approve on second reading of Ordinance O-2025-13, Trespass Enforcement Authorization Program, all those in favor signify by saying yes.
Yes. Yes.
All opposed signify by saying no. That motion carries by a vote of 7-0. 7B, election of the mayor pro tempore. Mr. Coker, would you summarize, please?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't realize this was my piece, but that's fine. Well, as we know, every 2 years, no, we're basically at a point now where we obviously have all the offices filled. And so the election of the mayor pro tem is really set up to allow for the what ifs. Let's just say the mayor goes on an Alaskan cruise and he's unable to be present. So it's really an opportunity for the council to elect of out of their own body, really who that next in line person is. I hope that's a reasonable description for you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Coker. I think it's quite reasonable. The beginning of this process is opening the floor for nominations. Each name nominated must also receive a second in order for it to be a candidate for election. And the floor is now open for nominations. Councilmember Williams.
Yes, I would like to nominate Councilmember Roche as mayor pro tem. She's demonstrated strong leadership and commitment to serving our community. With her experience on council and in the role of mayor pro tem for the last 2 years, I believe she would continue to represent the council well in this role.
I'll second that motion. Any further nominations? Councilmember Pinkerton.
Yeah, council, I'll nominate Aaron Roop.
Second.
I have a motion to nominate Aaron Roop with a second by Council Member O'Rear. Any further nominations? Hearing no further nominations, the floor is closed for additional nominations. So we have two candidates for Mayor Pro Tempore. Nominated candidates are now permitted to provide a brief statement prior to the election if they so choose. Councilmember Roche, do you wish to make any comments?
Sure. I've appreciated the opportunity to be mayor pro tem for the last 2 years. I appreciate the nomination and the second. I'm willing to perform those duties again if council should see fit. And if they choose somebody else, that's okay too. I have plenty on my plate, but I am willing, and thank you.
Councilmember Roop.
I'll keep it brief as well. It's been my privilege to work with each one of you, and I'm interested in serving in this next position because I want to make sure that I hear all sides and work together and work along with the mayor, staff, department heads that I've gotten to be a good relationship with, and I feel that would be my goal to just have a well communicated council that feels like they could come to me, and I feel like I could work with everybody here.
Thank you, Mr. Roop. So at this time, every member of council shall cast votes, and as by ordinance, you are required to vote for one of the two names that are up here. And since we have multiple nominations, the voting is going to be by ballot. You have been provided ballots. Find the one marked ballot round one and write in your choice. Pass it down to the clerk.
All right, Mayor, Councilmember Roche with 3 votes and Councilmember Roop with 4.
Congratulations, Mayor Pro Tem Roop. Thank you. That concludes the election of our Mayor Pro Tem and also concludes the items that are on our agenda for this evening. If there are no objections, we will stand adjourned.